So am I hearable?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Murphy, be quiet. You may not look like a Murphy, but you act like a Murphy. So I arrived here early, and we're starting 10 minutes late. So, welcome to East County. Oh, that's great. Today, I'm going to attempt to theorize a theology of creativity. And as I worked on this week and put together my slide presentation, I realized that I really don't want to be the person to talk about this. But I thought, well, why don't you just start with a poem that you like, and maybe everyone will forget about the theology of creativity. I'm great at typos, so this title of this poem is supposed to be "Don't Tempt the Monks." Those of you who watch closely will notice this week I have corrected the misspelling of resurrection on the slide. So Ty will not be able to tease me all week about the age of razor erection. And I love Danusha Lamaris. I just recently became aware of her, and I haven't read a poem by her that I dislike. So let's read this together and discuss it, and then see if that... Oh, I'm seeing other typos. I had to type this. I couldn't find it online. And then see if that can move us into the discussion today.
And just so you know, typos don't count.
Okay. "Don't tempt the monks," said the visitor's book at the Tibetan Buddhist monastery, and went on to clarify, "No bikinis, short shorts, or suggestive speech." Everywhere I went, there were monks in burgundy robes, monks meditating in the temple by golden Buddhas, monks sweeping under the redwood trees, bowing their shaved heads over bowls of lentil soup. The Dalai Lama said he sometimes dreams of women chasing him. What a narrow path we walk. I read a book about a geisha who falls for a monk. They spend years side by side, dipping their brushes in black sumae ink, painting flowers opening in the rain, the peaks of mountains covered in snow. Constraints are wonderful in art. I want very badly to tempt a monk, to lead one down a ragged bamboo-lined path of no return. By the pool, I even thought I saw one eyeing me in my bronze one-piece with the cut-out sides. What is it in us that wants to take whatever has ascended to the heights of spirit and pull it down into the mud to wallow with us in our own holy humanness? I have two copies of the front page. As if we needed to assure ourselves that is enough. This realm of rock and stream and dust to which we belong a little while before we bequeath our atoms to the wind. Or as if we'd be less alone if only we could anchor someone else here with the useful agent of the body, its improbable protrusions and silken passages, which is something the monks, too, must desire, enough to warrant a mention in the guest book, reminding all those passing through to have mercy, to leave them hovering right where they are, where we all are, so precariously perched between heaven and earth. What stands out to you in this poem. Holy humanness. I'm intrigued with that line, because to pull it down into the mud, to wallow with us in our own, the comma is not a typo. Holy humanness. I'm not sure what that means. Because if the comma wasn't there, it'd just be our own holy humanness. In our own, like putting this holy humanness as if to modify our own. And that's perplexing to my mind. Jen.
I really like the passage about the geisha. And just the final line of the constraints are wonderful in art, as if it's like calling out that they're wonderful in art, but maybe not elsewhere,
yeah,
is what my mind went to on that. And just that, I mean, the whole thing's great, but that really...
Yeah. And I found the images in that stanza to be sexual, desirous, you know, the dipping in the brushes, the painting flowers opening in the rain, peaks of mountains covered in snow. Yeah.
I like the her desire to disrupt by saying, you know, I wanted very badly to tempt the monk.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that too. Jeff.
For me, it's the dichotomy and the tension there of nature versus human nature that's in there, both with our place in the world, our place with each other, and our place within ourselves, that she traces through each of these, you know, and where that comes into conflict, where it's at peace, or and why it's not at peace in some places with monks who you think of being very much at peace, very much enlightened, here are not. They're very grounded. They're very human. They're very... And it's just speaking to it. I think that's the, in that, you know, what is it in our own being the collective, is it something we're going to call this holy humanness? Being the idea, like, the core right there. And I like that that's where you move to the next page, because that seems like where the tonally it shifts, you know, around that too. So.
Oh, those are great observations. Well, I'm curious if you had, if you wondered, like, in the context of a church class, why would we read this poem? Is that nobody? Just, Alpha.
And then she moves on, or maybe it's because we'd be less alone. And it just makes me realize that as we set ourselves apart, we even use that language, you know, that we turn away from sin. And, you know, there's a sense in which we're apart, we're different, we've raised to heights. And in doing that, we really risk leaving others out and leaving others alone. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that would be one of the reasons, you know, is to challenge me about my setting apart, you know, that I'm different. I've achieved something others haven't spiritually, and that leaves others out. And that's what this seems to me is addressing.
Kevin.
I'm not sure if this is an answer to your first question about what you hear, or your second question about hearing it in a Christian class, maybe both, I don't know. But it struck me in that first line, don't tempt the monks, and went on to clarify with suggestive speech. And then what she does is offer suggestive speech for the rest of the poem.
Yeah.
But not to tempt the monks, to affirm and stand with them, and therefore subverting the notion of suggestive speech in the first place. which connected with me when you asked your second question to your title about us being speech creatures and what suggestive speech could do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. No, I didn't think about that at all. Yeah. You know, when I first read this poem, and maybe I've read it several times, I thought the initial point of the poem was going to be, you know, the monks should just keep their eyes to themselves. I mean, this is the monks' problem. And would have been very right, I think, in writing that poem, but she went in a very different direction. And one of the things that was very convicting to me, at least, as I read this as a Christian, is what is it in us that wants to take whatever has ascended to the heights of spirit and pull it down in the mud, into the mud, to wallow with us? And I thought about that. I feel like especially as a younger man, a young boy, I was the preacher's kid. And so, and that's what everyone saw me. I was so lonely from that. And by that, and it was good. They said, oh no, that's the preacher's kid. He doesn't want involved in our sin. So like if I'm in, you know, I didn't get invited to parties. In the locker room when they were passing around Playboys, they passed it past me. And it was all very good things. But I would relish the opportunity if there was someone who was considered more good than me to team up with the other guys and bring that guy down. I loved it to not be me. I think about that, like there's something kind of fun in finding the strongest Christian and seeing if you can just bring them down a little bit. That's how I use my time. I don't know. And I went to a Christian college, and there was always someone with very, I don't know, great ethics who were like, I'm not going to see R-rated movies. And I'm like, I'm going to make that a goal. I don't know.
We don't like the holier than thou.
But, well, are there any other thoughts on this poem? Yes.
I don't know. I just felt like it was odd to me because I felt like this is the monk's home. And are these people coming in their swimsuits, tourists? Or, I was trying to understand how this would happen. There are some places we go that are spiritual places that, I mean, of course, when they set up that gauntlet of, you know, don't tempt the monks, it changes that feeling. But for a little while in the beginning, I was kind of buoyed along by, well, this is where they belong, and this is, they're doing what they do because they've chosen to do this. And it was interesting to think of how I understood her desire for there to be humanness that would connect us with any human. But it was interesting to me that I felt a little protective of the monks.
No, that's a great observation as well. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that monasteries offer retreats. I was intrigued about the swimming, the swimsuit as well. But I just kind of went with it, yeah.
I don't know if I'm answering a question here or what, but I always just appreciate things that break down distinctions, right? At the very beginning, there seems like this obvious polarity between these spiritual monks and the non-spiritual visitors. But then at the end, right, talks about how we are all hovering between heaven and earth, and you know, the imagery of being brought down to the mud, right, is very dirty, earthy, and yet also these beautiful scenes of nature, of the snow-capped mountains and the flowers opening up, you know, had very bodily, visceral connotations. Mm-hmm. So you blurred that line of, you know, holy nature, degraded nature.
Oh, okay.
You know,
more like
yeah, and just this, you know, and even her, you know, her bronze one piece with the cutout sides, how it, you know, got around the you know,
no bikinis,
short, yeah. You know, it's like we find ways to get around. If you define something, yeah. We'll find ways to blur that definition, yeah. And get around it. And it's just, but it was so blurring these lines, but it, you know, it changed this polarized situation into all of a sudden a spectrum, mm-hmm. that we're all on in different places.
Yeah, I was struck, still am struck in my brain. Of this, it's everybody's responsibility, right? Like, I mean, I get what you're saying about, like, you know, when you heard it, shouldn't it be the monk's responsibility? You know, keep your eyes down or control your own thoughts, right? And there, I think that's true. I think they live a life to practice that. I think they would agree with, yes. And it's also our responsibility. Like, it's a both and that tug and pull of, when do we want to take responsibility for others? When do we not want to take responsibility? There's no problem taking responsibility of the bringing down. There's the acknowledgement of, I want to so badly. Mm-hmm. I want to. But yet if you were to then, like, I just wonder if you were to say to somebody, you know, what you're doing is bringing down. How dare you? Don't tell me that. It's that person's responsibility. But yet in the same breath, you just acknowledge, but you want to. So it's just that I like that in my own brain, it makes me ask a lot of questions of the, how do we have responsibility for the collective? How do we have responsibility for all of us, right? It is an everyone.
Because certainly, you know, I can act in an adversarial way towards someone.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
I think it was Linda that mentioned we all want connection. And so I'm thinking shared vulnerability is what establishes connection. Mm-hmm. She's very aware of her vulnerability, mm-hmm. but kind of surprised to see, to come to her mind that their vulnerability was also exposed.
Yeah. And it's a great observation.
And that what they wanted was mercy, you know, to accept them in their vulnerability.
Oh, thank you for those thoughts. Well, then let's take a few minutes to at least get started on this theology of creativity. I'm going to have Nolan. I've got to change my program that I use. And I'm going to have to get my notes. But, you know, last week, could you go back, Nolan? I think, no, I meant back on the slide. All right, well, this is exactly as I planned it. Great, there it is. All right. Mm-hmm. Yes, that one, that's where I was. Oh, that's it? Can you go to the next slide? You know, this was introduced last week, how when God creates, he creates, you know, with his speech. He has speech creatures. And of all the speech creatures, The human is the only one he addresses directly. He's the only one he talks to, and the only one he calls you. I have given you every plant. And this indicates a special commitment that God has made to this speech creature by speaking directly to them and giving them the freedom to respond. The human is the best and the truest of the speech creatures. And so you can go down to the next slide now. And so, like, if you press play, it doesn't work. Oh, see, these were all supposed to, like, come up at certain times. Nah, that's all right, sorry. We'll see. So later, you know, the Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to till it and to keep it. So, you know, to till it, you know, indicates he's taking care of the garden. And I think to keep it is maybe, you know, keeping livestock, or maybe just another way of seeing keeping the garden. Can you hit that, Nolan? And so, you know, the human enhances the garden. It's not, even though God looked at it and saw it was good, he gives the human work to continue this creative endeavor to enhance it. And if you go ahead and just hit the next two, I guess. And also it indicates God is prepared to trust the human with the care of the garden. Go ahead, Nolan. And this speech creature shares in God's work. God created the garden, and now the human is continuing this creative endeavor and is trusted with this. The next slide, please. Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the man gave names to all the livestock, the birds in the sky, and all the wild animals. This is an example, again, of God created the animals, brings them to the man, and the man creates names for them. This is a collaborative endeavor. In the next slide. And I mean, if you guys have something to say, please interrupt. I have terrible vision in this eye, so if you are maybe this way farther, you might have to call out to, actually, probably over here too. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep, and while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh. The Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man and brought her to the man. Now, I don't know, I think, you know, it's a weird story. Like, why didn't they know the orangutan was a bad helper for the man? But, and what had to happen for that to be figured out? I don't know, but there is a challenge or a problem even, and God's response is creativity. He continues to create. And I mean, there are a lot of, with all of these stories at the beginning of Genesis, there are things that, you know, maybe irk us ethically, but I'm going to try not to veer off into that area today. Yes. Yeah.
With creation. I mean, he's made it, but you know, obviously when he creates man, there's this co-creator relationship that takes place.
Yeah.
He does it quickly, I think.
Yeah, so he said very quickly upon creating, God establishes this collaborative relationship with humans, that the earth is a collaborative, the universe is a collaborative project of God. And so, can you go to the next slide now, Nolan? Okay. So in those early chapters of Genesis, there is this paradigm established, a trope of sin and consequence and blessing. And it's, established in the garden where there's a sin. They eat from the tree of knowledge. And you can go ahead there. And the consequence, among other things, but primarily expelled from the garden. And then God creates again. This, I think, is a act of God to reach back down to the humans, an act of reconciliation. And so sin happens, there are consequences, but God continues to create to address this issue. And you can go to the next slide, please. So in Cain and Abel, what is the sin? Murder. So can you hit that, Nolan, please? Yeah. And what is the consequence? No. Yeah, he's sent off. Yeah, he's driven them from the soil and forced to wander the earth. And what is the blessing?
The mark.
Yeah, he says, anyone who finds me will kill me. So God gives him a mark. He creates this mark to protect him from the very sin he committed. And the next one is the flood. So this one is another one of those I know that is particularly troublesome for us. But without trying to veer too much in that, God looks at all of creation, not just one or two people, but all of creation. It's just constant wickedness. And so, and he's grieved that he made the earth. So what does he do? What's the consequence? Is the flood. But the blessing here is, because we're looking at all of humanity, and I think presumably the idea is that if there wasn't the flood, Noah's going to get murdered or something terrible. But he saves Noah. He saves humanity. And this is kind of a midpoint in these early chapters of Genesis. God sends creation back to a watery chaos. And out of it, he recreates. And the language there, it very much reimagines the language of creation. When they come out of the ark, he tells them to go out and fill the earth. I give you the animals and the plants for food. He's recreating once again through Noah. And even the ark, God provides the blueprints. Noah does the work. It's a collaborative, creative endeavor. After this moment of recreation, I don't know, this is the part I like. So Nolan, we're about to finish this part up. A very thoughtful presentation there. So you have this issue. Ham sees Noah's nakedness. And the consequence is Ham is cursed. And of course, Shem and Japheth, less so Japheth, he gets to live in Shem's tent, but Shem is blessed. Now, this is what's interesting. So everything, all these stories are connected through genealogies. I think I have this on the next slide. I do not. One more. All right, so what is this? Oh, yeah, the sin of Babel. They want to make a name for themselves. And also maybe, they say they don't want to be scattered, which would be in violation of what God said to do after the flood. But we'll go with make a name for themselves. And the consequence? The language is confused and the people are scattered. And the blessing. Does anybody know the blessing of the Tower of Babel? Excellent. Because if you would have ruined everything if you knew the answer. So this paradigm is established. And please go to the next slide, Nolan. And And we have all these series of stories that are connected by genealogy. Something happens, God creates. Something happened, God creates. And you have, you know, Cain and Abel, and then this genealogy that leads down to Noah. And then you get Noah's story. And then you have the Noah and his sons, and a genealogy that comes to the Tower of Babel. But none of the characters are in. There are no names in the Tower of Babel. So please progress, Nolan. Go ahead. So this, if you see the breakdown in the story, you can hit that one more time. So the genealogy goes Japheth, Ham, Shem. Can you hit that one more time, Nolan? And then from Shem, you get the Tower of Babel. But Shem isn't a character in the Tower of Babel. And one more time, Nolan. After the Tower of Babel, you get Shem again. So oddly, his genealogy brackets the Tower of Babel. And I'm told, I don't read Hebrew, but I'm told people who read Hebrew pick up on something very interesting in this section of Genesis. So if you can hit this one more time. This is Robert B. Robinson. Is he a relative? Yeah? Okay. Okay, we'll see. So in Genesis 11:4, the tower builders explain the purpose of their common enterprise. In Hebrew, the word name is Shem or Shem or Shame, I don't know. The name of Noah's first son. The play on the word Shem reveals a profound irony. The whole earth marshals its energy to make a Shem for itself. But even before the people come together to their task, God has already provided a Shem. So they came together to make a name for themselves, even though, I mean, really, from the very beginning, God has provided these speech creatures with a name. He's made them his image. Can you hit that again, Nolan? And one more time. So So here's the thing. You have this paradigm established, and you get to the Tower of Babel, and you're waiting for the blessing. It's what you've been trained to look for, and it doesn't come. What you get is another genealogy of Shem. And hit that one more time. Okay. Is there was there a slide skipped? Maybe? No. Hit that one more time. Okay, we'll stop. So what happens is after the Tower of Babel, you get the genealogy of Shem, and then you get the call of Abram, in which God says, I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to make your name great. God is once again starting a creative endeavor with a person, with a speech creature. And I don't know if all of that matters, if it's coming out and making sense, but in my mind, a theology of creativity is just creativity. That God is a creative being and he responds creatively, and the human can participate in being creative. Can you hit that one more time, Nolan? Let's see if I wrote down. Oh, and I think God looks for creative collaborators, and when we create, we participate in new creation. When we are creatives, we are participating in new creation. And I'll stop there, and I do have a little bit to talk about, like this age of resurrection. But we have a few minutes if somebody wants to try and clear this all up for me. Over here.
So the tower, that was a creative response. So how does that fit in? You know, the Babel or Babel mm-hmm. tower, right?
Well, I think it was adversarial. Like, it was creativity apart from God. And that maybe is just in their ambition to make a name for themselves, and it may be rooted in the ambition. But no, that's a great point. I hadn't thought of that. Thanks for doing that to me.
Maybe there's a descriptor creation that leads us to alone creation that does not.
Can you say that again?
So maybe there's a participate in new creation, but maybe the descriptor is creation that leads to shalom.
Oh, that's
versus
that's
creating a nuclear bomb would not lead to shalom.
No, that's a great yes. Thank you. Saved. That's a great observation. Thank you, Shannon.
One of the fundamental aspects of creation is otherness. You're creating something else that's not you. There's difference. There's multiplicity. There's diversity. Tower of Babel was just the opposite of that. It was moving in the other direction. Everything was becoming one, so there is no longer difference. There is no longer multiplicity. There is no longer otherness. And so in that sense, it was a creative act that uncreated the goodness that was being offered.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. Yeah, that's great.
I can't help but think of the way that God's creation is constantly being attacked, and the fact that the whole planet that he's created is being mined, pumped of all of the things that he created that give the planet hydraulics, whatever it is, the oil that's pumped out of the ground, that we take for granted. We think that it was created for us to use. But I don't believe that. We're completely destroying something and we're taking it for granted, this wonderful creation that's unique in the universe. And yet we've chosen, and we take this the verses from the Bible, and we give ourselves permission, because it's ours, or it's not. We're giving the gift of living on it for a period of time, but we take all that for granted. Yeah. And we have no idea the repercussions and what we're denying future generations. We've taken for granted. And they will never see that or experience it, or they will live in a situation where their planet has been devastated. And I can't imagine how God sees that and feels about this incredible creation that we take it for granted.
Yeah. You know, thank you for those thoughts. And it seems like the exploitation of the planet benefits very few.
Back to Shannon's comment. Sorry, I'm stealing it. You know, creation that leads to shalom.
So I wonder, when we create, there's the possibility of participating in new creation, but there are also other possibilities. There are destructive possibilities that can come out of our creation, or things that we would say are not good. And God, in the narrative, creates and at some point says, not good, and then creates more or different. So I think there's that dynamic at work, even for God.
In this narrative. Thank you for those thoughts. Melinda.
So So it's interesting when I think back to your to all of the examples. Every time he created, not every time, but a lot of times when he created, there was difference in the creation. He didn't replicate the same thing over and over and over again. And I think so often we limit in our I limit in my mind what the definition of creativity is. Oh, you're a poet, you're creative. Oh, you're an artist, you're creative. Oh, you can do this, you're create. You can dance, you're creative. Oh, you're musical, you create. Therefore, those are the only things that make people creative. Mm-hmm. And yet, within each story, how God created was different. It wasn't all making flowers and the oceans and the, you know, sometimes it was setting up a society. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like, the creativity is different each time. Mm-hmm. And to me, when I hear we can participate in that creativity, it is, there is so much more to be creative about. You know, creative is a mindset. And how we think about things, right? And that I love, I was having a conversation this week with a coworker I've talked about before, Chris. And I love, you know, he's Navajo, and he always refers to the creator. There is no other word but the creator, and he'll do it in ways that make me realize creativity and creation comes in so many different forms. Sometimes it's mathematical. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's science. Sometimes, right? And we get to participate in that endless mm-hmm. aspect of creativity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that just made me think about, like, I just quit my job, like, at an oil company. And, there are, like, other solutions in that industry, like, besides, like, oil that 100% comes from the ground. Like, there are creative solutions that just haven't been monetized, but it took, like, creative people to come up with renewable lubricants, to come up with renewable diesel, and then the people that wanted to support that to, like, put laws into place in Portland and in the state of Oregon that are trying to make those things become, like, more marketable and more widely used. So it's like, or like the laundry detergent thing. Like, we use those, like, Earth Breeze sheets. Why didn't we do that first? Why did we come up with these giant jugs? I don't know. It just became marketable. But, like, creative people, we need those in businesses, too.
Sure.
To, like, make those solutions actually viable. Yeah. So that's just sort of, like, something I was thinking about based on what two people have now said.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you for those thoughts. Well, we'll try it again next week. Thank you.